Okay, everyone, I'm told we're tracking down a note taker. Before that, we'll go ahead and start with introductions so that we don't get behind. Welcome, my name is Chris Hughes. I'm the Program and Outreach Coordinator in the Voting Rights Institute in the Office of Ohio Secretary of State, Jennifer Bruner. I will go ahead and introduce our panel, and they will start with some introductory statements and then expound perhaps a little bit more on the subject matter that you see before you. And then, of course, if you have any input or questions, that's what we're here for. So the gentleman sitting to my right is not Ned Foley. This is Nathan Semenska. He also joins us from the Moritz College of Law and is, I'm told, or has been for some time, the editor of Election Law at Moritz, the website, which I know I've gone to quite a few times myself. And then we have Candace Hoke, who is, first, I'm proud to say, a member of VRI's Advisory Council. She's also the director for the Center for Election Excellence. And then, of course, Tom Worley, who is the chief of staff, also at the Ohio Secretary of State's office. So we'll start with you, Nathan, if that's okay. If you want to go ahead and give some introductory remarks?
Yeah, that's fine. So we're supposed to talk about two things, the national change of address service and then the possibility of digitized signatures in the database and other updates to the database. So I'm hardly an expert in the National Change of Address Service or how it works, but I did recently consult on a project for the United States Election Assistance Commission where we surveyed. It ended up being 49 states, and some of those were actually territories, but entities. About what they thought about the National Change of Address Service and how that worked. And that's not really what we're here to talk about today, because we are supposed to use it here in Ohio and we don't have much of a choice about that, at least as the statutes are written. But the question that we're supposed to talk about is, should we consider using this program not only to identify people who have moved and start the process whereby they will be removed from the database, but could we use it proactively to prevent these sorts of problems that we've been talking about, or mitigate them, where people are voting at the wrong polling place because they've moved and they don't understand? Can we look at these national change of address lists and say, hey, this person moved, send them a letter that tells them, hey, you know, you moved outside the precinct, or maybe you even moved outside the county. You really need to re-register, otherwise, you know, there could be consequences for you. And it's very sensitive how you phrase this to people. And apparently there has been a program done on a voluntary basis at some boards of elections to try to do this. So you just need to word it properly. So, I mean, my opinion about that program is that it sounds like a good idea to me. I mean, I don't really see a whole lot of reasons why you wouldn't want to do something like that. I think it's good to have a pilot program like some people are apparently doing to see how it works. I do think that you need to consider little wrinkles or imperfections that exist within the National Change of Address program right now, and build your pilot program or whatever it ends up being in a way that accounts for those. So in the EAC survey that I looked at, there were a number of complaints that states had about the National Change of Address Service. And particularly, I can list them. One of them is that oftentimes it will misidentify voters as having moved if they have the same name as everyone who lives in their house or apartment, and one of them moves for whatever reason. Sometimes, say seven people with the last name Semenska, which is my last name, live in a house, and one of them moves, and it will say all seven of these people moved. Well, then if you're using this to identify people who have moved, you're going to at the very least be wasting resources and time by trying to get these people who haven't moved re-registered at a new place, and you may be confusing people. There's a number of other ways that it can apparently misidentify things. If you change your mailing address but you don't actually change where you live, say I don't know, you're sick in the hospital or something, it doesn't have really any ability to catch that. A lot of people who live in Ohio, like we do, try to get the heck out of here during the winter. And that can be a problem too, where if you don't fill out the forms properly when you're leaving your forwarding address, it can think that you're supposed to say it's just temporary, you're going down to Florida for 4 months or whatever, but if you don't fill it out properly, then that could affect this program. So I guess all I'm saying is it sounds like a good idea overall, but you know, you just need to take these sorts of things into account. That's it.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Candace Hoke. I'm here from Cleveland. I have a considerable amount of background on the technical side of elections, as well as the administrative side. And as we all know, and I know many of you are election officials, some of you are advocates, we have a rather uneven record in this nation and in this state for being able to use technology in an appropriate manner. We frequently, and I'd say this at the congressional level as well as right down the system, we tend to see, our policymakers often see the promise of the technologies, but they don't fully understand the risks, and they don't understand it at the level that's needed to protect the jobs of employees who are having to use this system and want to do it right, but could make grievous errors that cost people their rights to vote. That's the employee and administrative side. The voter side, of course, is loss of the right to vote, or the other side of that piece is allowing the registration of individuals who are really fraudulent. And it's the job of the election system to protect the integrity of the registrations. That's, as we all know, the entrance into the entire system. I'm a great supporter of modernizing voter registration. I believe that we should be looking into the automatic adult registration approach that is being pushed at the national level. I think we should look at it at the state level. But we must understand and control for the risks to the entire system and its integrity and in usability. Now on that, when we start looking closely at the voter registration, the statewide voter registration databases and the ability to register online, there are some models for doing that that would actually enhance the possibility for fraud at the same time as they would enhance access. And I trust all of us in this room wouldn't endorse that. On the other hand, with some high-quality technical understandings about computer security and computer design, computer application design, we could actually create a quality system that would allow, for instance, the voter registration form to be online, be filled out online, downloaded, printed, and mailed in, while at the same time appearing in a database that's a temporary database to then allow the signed form to come in and then be verified, and then there could be additional steps at that point. But what is very dangerous would be to allow the registrations to occur online without any kind of additional verification steps. And that's the piece that a number of states don't quite get yet. And at the federal level, we need to understand that. So that's one piece of the technical side. The other is that these databases have nationwide, the statewide voter registration databases, have not been designed with the kinds of high-level technical computer security protections that are needed. And the usability isn't there for the election managers as well, meaning at the state and the local level. So this is all of a piece. It has to be thought out together, and the appropriate level technologists or computer scientists have to be involved, and they've by and large not been, which is part of the reason that we are in the situation that we're in today with statewide voter registration databases not working. So where I would, my own point of view, and we definitely want to be talking about this, is that the access has to, the goals of access have to be combined with true integrity, verifiable integrity, which means auditing and checking on every aspect of those databases and the registration system to ensure that they can't be manipulated, which is a protection for our democratic system and of the employees and managers who are there. So that's where I would leave you. One other piece, there is an organization which is a nonprofit in California called the Open Source Digital Voting Group. There are a number of open source groups, but this one is a special one that is working on both a high level, highly secure, far lower risk internet registration system, sort of like the kind that I have described to you. And it's working assiduously to try to have that available for states to be able to adopt in roughly a year and a half. It's going to depend in part on its foundation funding, but that's a possibility. And we should all be looking for those kinds of systems because Silicon Valley is sort of known for some high quality computer work. Thank you.
Good afternoon. In terms of the initial topic that's dealing with the national change of address and dealing with the US Postal Service, every 2 years, there is an initiative taken where the U.S. Postal Service provides to the state, and in this case, the Secretary of State's office, a listing of all changes of addresses that they have identified in the postal regions of Ohio. We then take that information and actually give it to a vendor who then compares it against our statewide voter registration databases and see if there are matches in terms of potential changes that have occurred. We then receive that information, divide it up by county. We send out a CD to each county, and the county then sends out a confirmation notice to the voters in those situations, trying to make sure that they have identified what may be now their current address. This is a process the Board of Elections go through every 2 years. It is important because a person's eligibility to vote in the future requires some activity, and that activity may be responding to this confirmation notice, or it's voting or signing a petition. But if there is no activity for at least 4 years, including two federal elections, an individual could find that their registration is no longer valid. So from that standpoint, it's a very important process. How we work with the U.S. Postal Service in other ways, Ohio is received a special grant from the Pew Charitable Trust to work on one of their Make Voting Work projects, and that was to have two registration cards put in a moving packet or the welcome kit. So when you go to move, the Postal Service has a vendor called Imagitas that will send you a packet of information to remind you, update your utilities, update this, a variety of information. But in that packet, in Ohio, at least in 45 of our counties for the regions that are under this test program, they're receiving two voter registration forms. It became a little bit more complicated because the postal regions don't line up with Ohio's borders. So it required us involving Kentucky and Indiana for some of our regions to participate, at least for those counties that joined the Ohio counties in that postal district. And so we did it for the Cleveland, Columbus, and Cincinnati postal regions. We began this project in February of 2008 for Cleveland and Columbus, and we began the Cincinnati project, I believe, in June of 2008. We are collecting information that is going through academics who have joined us on this project, who will evaluate the effectiveness of this. What type of response will we get when people move? We're tracking the cards as they come back to see if they came from this source versus a different source. Will it be that we'll find 5% of the people used it right away and took advantage of it? Will it be 10%, 20%? How many did that? And how does that impact our Board of Elections, that they get the information sooner, right when people move, rather than get deluged right at the last minute before the time of the election when people go, oh my gosh, I forgot, I've changed my address, I need to update my registration program. So the cost of this, both in terms of the academic review and the postage and such, has been covered under the grant of the Pew Charitable Trust, and probably the Jet Foundation also was supporting this project. And so Ohio's at the cutting edge trying to see what services might be helpful in this regard. Obviously, if it's found to be effective, that doesn't mean we would have the funding as a state agency or as a state to do this across Ohio, or the difficulty would be we would have to get all adjoining states who have these postal regions to join us, and if they did not, the Postal Service would not agree to do the program. It's either for everybody in their district or in that region or no one in that region. Certainly, Pew will have a chance to see the productivity and the effectiveness of this program to determine, is it something to advocate nationally? Should it be something that's just done across the country, federally funded, and then from that standpoint, we had a chance here in Ohio to see if that program worked. So on the initial topic that's kind of dealing with the national change of address, U.S. Postal Service, what are we doing now, what could we do in the future, those would be my comments.
Okay. And actually, I know Secretary Carnahan in Missouri, after hearing some of the initial part of that project in particular, was like, well, why don't we just do this nationally? And I guess Pew and the academics were like, let's study it first, and you know, then we'll see what we can do. Kind of as a follow-up, that's kind of where we are now, perhaps in association with the U.S. Postal Service. Is there somewhere you see in the future that could be a higher level of cooperation or service with them that would help us better track and maintain voter registrations for anybody here?
We'd very much like for you all to participate in this, okay?
Oh, don't worry, we'll get there.
So thank you. Go ahead.
I don't have any ideas right off the top of my head.
Okay. I guess we'll open it up for questions and comments. First, one thing I want to point out, I know kind of in the division that I am, when I hear NVRA, the first thing I think of is designated agencies and that part of the law, et cetera. While this panel is not meant to focus on that, nor would I ask our panelists to be experts in that area, if you have any comments around that area, certainly we can take those back. Or you're welcome to share those at any point with my division in Secretary of State's office. Yes, ma'am.
I'm Jan Clare from Lake County, an elections official, and as a result of the National Voter Right Act and the changes that we encountered with that, it is a good thing that in the odd year after the federal election, we do have the ability to clean up our file fleet, as we would say. And on that database that we receive two types of lists. One that are definitely, these people have moved, you should remove them from your file. I have 160,000 registered voters. Of that first report in 2005, I was able to remove almost 5,000 people. The supplemental portion of that report are those that they believe may have moved, triggering the confirmation card. That was 28,000 people that were automatically then sent a confirmation card and would be mandated to vote a provisional ballot. They did not respond to the confirmation card, which I think we should be revisiting the design, because interestingly enough, a number of people that received the confirmation card at the same address, and we advise them you need to update this information, appeared to vote for governor in 2008 and were just absolutely astonished that they had to vote provisional because they said, you mailed it to my address, you knew where I was. So why did I have to update it? So we need to revisit the design as we get ready to do this mailing. That would be my suggestion, Tom.
That's an excellent idea. We've heard and seen, I received calls all through the fall from voters who had received communications from various boards of election that were trying to alert them to various problems in their registration, but their interpretation was very different from those of us in this room who are, we could say, junkies for elections. We know what precinct means. We know what provisional ballot means. All these terms, they were confusing. And so one of the suggestions is to take the learning from the ballot design workshop and to actually, at the boards of election, to ask some citizens to read your drafts before they go out, be they postcards, and I know some of this is mandated by law, but for whether the communication is actually getting through to average citizens of a variety of educational background, and because these letters are written for us instead of for them, and that's another example of the communication is a very good idea.
Well, and on a follow-up to that, as we prepared for our presidential election, knowing that we had a potential 28,000 provisional voters already on our roll, we did a follow-up letter, Candace, where we literally said, you received a mailing from the Board of Elections that you did not respond to. We are enclosing a registration form. You need to update your information. As a result of that, we were able to clean up about 14,000 voters prior to the presidential. But that will be an effort that we go through with due diligence. It's going to increase the number of rolls, and I don't know in the other states, those academias in the room could probably advise Ohio, is the same procedure done with respect to the national change of address and the way that they're handling having two parts to that listing and whether or not they're actually putting voters into provisional status, which increases the number of provisional voters the state of Ohio then will be incurring.
Yeah, I think I can speak to that. 26 out of the 49 jurisdictions that were surveyed in the Election Day survey indicated that they do use the National Change of Address service in some form. The rest indicated that they do not use it. A few indicated that they had used it in the past, but were not satisfied with it or thought that it was too expensive or some other reason. As far as your question about do they provide a list of people who have certainly moved versus people who potentially may have moved, I do not know the answer to that question. The other question that you asked is if they are sent out a confirmation postcard and do not respond to it, are they forced to vote a provisional ballot? The answer to that is definitely it depends on state. The variation in the rules that determine whether you are required to cast a provisional ballot and whether that provisional ballot will count vary tremendously across all 50 states. So I'm sure that there are some states where failure to return one of those postcards requires provisional voting, but I think it's probably less than 10.
Before we get to your question, Brian, could I ask the election officials in the room to comment on whether you would like for the administrative and policy system to try to move toward greater automation? Is it something that you trust? Because I know there are some of you in the room, for instance, our friends in Cuyahoga, who have a flawed database, and they know quite well that databases that are supposed to be state-of-the-art could be marketed as such and actually perform in a completely different way. So with that, your question first or your comments first, Brian.
Well, on the issue of automation, I'll speak to that.
That'd
certainly
be great.
Whatever we could automate is welcomed, particularly because automation not only speeds it up, it improves consistency across the board within our agency and typically provides a much better audit trail than processes we do manually. So anytime that we could, and an audit process is, which leads into my comment, and my comment is really more feedback for Tom, I think, as we go into the NBRA, that is an automated process. The template that we use is provided to us by the Secretary of State. It is a two-up postcard that comes back. It's a lot of information. And it's good that it does come from the Secretary of State, because there's no opportunity then to forget putting forwarding mail requirements and all sorts of other things. But I sent the letter to the office 2 years ago when we went through this process. We received in Summit County, I probably got three or four letters and two or three phone calls, which is a lot on one particular issue. People complaining that when they do exercise that request for them to sign to show that they're still out there, they have to sign it with their signature and put it back in the mail, and they're very apprehensive about putting an exposed, open-faced postcard through the mail with their original signature on it. It feels wrong to a lot of people, and my hunch is that there's a number of people who don't mail that back in because they don't want to send a postcard that confirms their address open-faced through the mail. There's some they're with their signature on
That's
it.
A good point.
So in terms of a usability analysis, I think one of the things I'd like to encourage you to look at is that signature placement on the postcard that comes back. And I know that there are ways to fold postcards so that that can be
just
protected, and just to throw it out as a thought.
That'd be great.
All right, thanks. We are in a smaller group than some of the sessions, so it's easy to hear everyone. And I'll play second fiddle to the facilitator to remind, if you could go to the microphone, though, and not because people can't hear you, but because we are doing an audio recording of the session, and that way we can capture everybody's thoughts and questions and concerns. But it's an excellent opportunity to know that yet in another county there is a return envelope, so to offer that sense of privacy for the voter in terms of returning this information. And so it's good to know that we there are other options under consideration. I realize when we send out information, we often do it in a form of a directive with very specific instructions on how it's going to be handled or the structure of the form itself. And so I will take note so not to have to wait for an audio recording, to know that this is an issue for us to discuss because we anticipate things going out in the near future. And obviously, we will not necessarily use the same directive that we did in 2007, though it'll be similar here in 2009. And I think that is work still in process. Thank you.
One other just small piece of information. If the sign-up sheet has not reached you, please make sure that you do sign your, thank you very much, name and email address. Not just in interest for us to have your information, but also so that we can keep you updated on the results of this session.
I have another question for you all, and some of this may have been discussed in some other workshops, but if you could right, or if you had a magic wand to change some of the registration rules in Ohio, what would be top of your list? Either procedures or legal mandates. Do you have some recommendations that you can share with the group?
Now we've got some people getting up.
I would just say what was said yesterday in another session, but say it very emphatically with regard to the registration card. We can tell you at the Board of Elections the most frequent reasons why a registration card fails, which we have to then send out. And I think the card needs to be redesigned with usability analysis by graphics artists with the knowledge of what are the pieces of information the voter doesn't put in enough. And Cuyahoga County mentioned they highlight theirs in yellow, the areas that they must fill. All those types of ideas could be done by design professionals, I think, and we would all benefit. We'd save a lot of postage mailing back thousands of cards, not cards, but thousands of blank cards telling people to get it right. The one thing that I would say is, since box one and two are no longer necessary because we're an affidavit state, those two boxes at the top, they're duplicative, they're needlessly confusing, and they take up space on the form that could be used for other purposes. So I would recommend personally amping up the size of the affidavit or the declaratory statement that the voter is signing to and taking that space back for other purposes, box one and two, that says, are you going to be 18, are you 18 and are you a citizen?
Other thoughts? Please identify yourself too, that'd be great.
Hi, Kelly Polanyi, Director, Trumbull County Board of Elections. We all need to send all the citizens to handwriting school for one thing, but we know that's not possible. So many of the times, registration card, the printing, or however the voters write in is illegible. So along with Brian, maybe like the federal postcard application, make little squares where they have to write in each of their letters or something, and that would help us be able to process registrations better. But back to your question about automated registration practices, and this has already been brought up before, but one of our office's pet peeves is data entry from BMVs is very poor. They have a lot of typos. Mm-hmm. So I'm really worried about if we can connect with the BMV state database, if their information is bad and we got bad information from them, we're not going to be able to verify anything in the end. And if it's bad information and then we get it in automated, then we're still getting bad information. Mm-hmm. So that you just have to really consider that. Thank
Very
you.
Good points. And just to follow up on the DVN, the DMV databases, some of you probably know that even the Social Security database is estimated to have, in their own estimation, their own assessments, 20% errors. Okay, 20% even in that database. So that raises some very significant questions about matching. Going back to the question about automation and online registration, one of the interesting points about this model that the Open Source Digital Voting Group is promoting, you remember I described it that a voter could go to the internet and bring up a voter registration form, fill it out online, which of course means it's typed, print it and sign it, and then they have to mail that in, but that it is automatically sent to whatever is the registration unit, be it a local board of election or a state. And then it sits there so that if the signed form comes in, it can be pulled down and it's already typed and ready to enter, so you don't have the labor or the error rates of, unless the voter makes errors in typing, but that's already input. So it's a question of whatever additional verification one wants. And so that I thought that's a very interesting model, and their view is that this is where you enhance the accuracy through using and not increase the risk. So it's an interesting model for us to be thinking of. Go ahead.
I think that's an excellent idea. During November, we had a number of the younger people, the now generation, that is how they live their lives. And they were downloading registration forms and then signing them and forwarding them in. That was wonderful.
Okay.
Then we had another group that was out there generating registration forms with inaccurate data and old data that created an absolute nightmare for us.
And very costly, too.
Very costly. And it was along with the layering that we go through with the BMVs.
Right.
The amount of inaccurate data that we receive from them, or people who have renewed their driver's license at an address that does not exist, of which we receive a copy. Something I learned during the past presidential, which I did not know before. I had some people come in, they insisted they had registered at a license bureau, and we did not have their registration. They did remember the license bureau the day in which they registered, and I contacted that license bureau, and I was not aware that they have a generated monthly report of all those voter registration forms. And I've been doing this quite a few years, and I don't know about you, but I was very impressed to think, wow, we actually have the means by which they can forward us a copy or a listing so we can anticipate. We also then could have a listing that we could turn around providing back to them that they have insecure data out there. And we don't combine our jury draws at the local level in our county because there is no means by which we can cleanse the data between an elections file and a BMV file. So, I quiver when I hear about we want to be able to download all this data, because you're absolutely right, Candace. That data would not be good data by which we would want to conduct an election.
Very dangerous, yeah.
Peggy Byers, Washington County. And just the suggestion that you change that bottom line where you can put your email address or your phone number there to make it more inviting, that they'll actually offer to give it to us, because if their address was bad or we can't read that writing, as somebody else said, we have no way to get back to them, and they're not registered and we can't take care of it. Okay, another line, and just another thought. As you're updating all this stuff, would it be possible to somehow communicate that, hey, these are possible projects we're working on or whatever, so we don't buy 10,000 of anything that's going to be outdated in the next 2 weeks or whatever? That does happen. And along the another line, and just this more for Tom than anything, gosh sakes, we have to get some of these communications a lot faster. In the last 2 weeks, this is a horrible experience that we went through. We are a BOD county, so we don't have to be so fast to make our ballot, but the other little counties around us don't have BOD, so their technical person has to be around faster. So he calls me up and wants to get in on the end of that route when he's coming to our part of the state, because he worked with those other counties, asked for me to finish up the ballot on Wednesday. We had a wonderful day, got through a bunch of stuff, had all of our data ready, and our part-time people were going to go on some kind of vacation or something like that. So on Friday, we're LNA testing. Well, Friday night, we get the directions that say, this is how you set the ballot up. All the directions were different, and we're back at ground zero. You just have to work faster or be ahead of us.
All right. We understand one of the greatest challenges, and actually was even more onerous for us running up for the November ballot for all the ballot issues that were local level that were coming up. And what we did was, rather than have kind of one primary person assigned in the elections division, we had three people assigned, even in an off year, to work on initial ballot review. We've also expanded our number of election attorney staff from 4 to 5 in order to better prepare, and we also basically borrow one or two other attorneys from our staff to look at the ballot language. So as much as you're indicating, there's still more improvements to do, Tom. I'm hearing that. But nonetheless, we have made modifications even since last fall. I can say also last fall, when we were dealing with this ballot language, we had the attorneys working through the weekend, and you might recall the big windstorm that came through and took out about a fourth of the trees in Ohio. And I was there with one of the election attorneys at night, and unfortunately, the shingles came off of her house, the neighbor called, and she had to go home. But we split up that work with three other attorneys the next day to try to get it done. So as much as there still can be questions coming from the Board of Elections, how can we still find yet a way to get the information to us faster? Sometimes the information we receive, we have questions on, and that slows down the process because we have to reach the Board of Elections, and sometimes there's a delay in being able to reach. But other times it rests on our shoulders and our productivity level, and we're trying to look at new ways within our staff configuration to make sure we can be more responsive. So I'll take note.
Actually, ma'am, I think I saw Norman jump up. If you wanna, okay. Are you sure? Okay.
Norman, I just wanted to make one quick statement, because we haven't had a lot of election officials input in a lot of these sessions, so I appreciate today that you really are hearing more and more from us. One of the things that caused us great pain during this last election was a good registration that did not have a date at the bottom, that they hadn't dated it. And there were thousands of people in the state of Ohio that, because we had to have them dated at the bottom, that we had to return those and not be able to process. And that created quite a lot of difficulty for voters. And they were upset. Send me back a form because I didn't date it, and now I'm disenfranchised from voting in this election.
Thank you. Norman? Norman.
Daddy, who knows a lot more than I do. Just a minor addition. Somebody else said what I was going to say to one extent about the non-existent addresses. There's a really large number of them. I saw the Cuyahoga County data recently. For 08, there were about 8,000 in one county alone of registrations with non-existent addresses. So that is a serious problem. And usually whatever happens in Cuyahoga multiply by four or five and you've got the state. So it does work out, rule of thumb, somewhere in there. And so that would be, say, four times 32,000 non-existent addresses statewide, something like that. So I just want to add to what one of the other elections officials said, that phone number, of course, is the only way you can reach somebody, but it says optional. Now, I've been out registering voters lots and lots, and what happens is you ask them to fill out the registration form, and it says optional, so they don't put in the phone number. And then you explain, well, it really helps to have it because it allows the Board of Elections to follow up, blah, blah, blah. And they only use it for that, you know, and then they write it in. Almost everybody. There are some people that won't. And so what I would say is somehow, not only, as Brian said, you know, maybe make it more, put more room on the form for something like that, but also change the word from optional to encouraged. So it's still not required, but it's encouraged. And then with an asterisk, and then explain, maybe in larger letters at the bottom, why it's encouraged. So, and then you also have to get that word out to people that are registering voters. And also, this is the second thing that I've seen from, I've worked with lots of volunteers who register voters, is they'll ask somebody something like, do you need to register to vote? And people will shake their heads, and they will go walking by, and then you say, or change of address, as they're nearly out the door, and they'll say, oh, yeah, and then they come back. So I think training on some of these things that go into the registration forms, you need both the personal as well as the user, you know, usability stuff. And I'd actually like to get some feedback on those suggestions from some of the election officials here, if they would mind.
Oh, good. Here's another. Please, election officials, let us hear from you.
Okay. Hi, I'm Betty Edwards. My ears are blocked, so hopefully I'm not yelling at you, okay? Can't hear myself.
Sound great, Betty.
Cuyahoga County. I love my registration card, okay? Initially, my predecessor, Mike DeFranco, decided we needed to highlight areas on the registration card, which he did. However, when I became his assistant manager, I decided along with him that we needed to go further and highlight everything that was mandatory. And that's what we did. And by highlighting everything that is mandatory, we have cut our fatal pending missing information cards down to about half, okay? So it does work. It does work. We don't have a clean database, and I welcome NCOA. I welcome anything and everything that's going to help me do my job and serve the people of Cuyahoga County. So we're working on a lot of duplicates now. Those of you who've been calling and sending your duplicate resolutions, we are responding, we are working. We have cut down, well, we've taken care of duplicate resolutions so far this year, upwards of 20,000. Okay, so we're getting there. Just bear with us. Eventually, we'll get it all cleaned up. That's about it, Michael.
If I could ask you a question, both of you. When you went to the highlighted card, because I've seen them, they're yellow highlights on the white card, did it substantially add to the cost, or were the costs offset by not having to follow up? I mean, how do you weigh the fiscal aspect of that change?
There was no effect to the cost at all for us. We had our county print shop do it.
Great.
Sir, could you identify?
Mike DeFranco, Cuyahoga
okay.
County. I just wanted to follow up with something what Dr. Robbins said about the cards that we receive that have bad addresses. We do get a lot of those, and I think part of the problem there is, and I'm not saying that they shouldn't do this, but when they pay people to register people to vote, they get our list, They go out there and it's happening, and we know it's happening. They're writing down fictitious addresses and they're getting paid for this. We have to accept the card. We have no choice if there's a signature on the card and all the required information is there. So maybe if it went down to something where, I know years ago they used to have deputy registrars, if it went back to that, or people were trained before they have somebody filling out a card for somebody else, make sure the voter's filling out the card and not somebody else filling out the card for the voter. Because a lot of times information's being misinterpreted too, why somebody else is filling out the card for the voter.
I think you've put your finger, Mike, on one of the reasons why the press for automatic adult registration is getting a lot of attention, because we have these problems with the solicitation of paid solicitation of addresses. It puts tremendous burden on the system, creates some very troubling incentives for fraud, registration fraud, but we all know that it also raises the cost of the entire system. So if we can systematize in a better way, automate in a better way without increasing fraud, that would be a good thing, right?
Exactly.
So, but we've got to do something about all these databases that have errors.
And we get thousands, literally thousands of cards a month. We spend more time trying to figure out the bad ones than the good people that are filing their change of address on time. And those are the people we should be spending our time with, not the fictitious ones.
And when we start thinking about the cost of elections and the pressure on our budgets today, we need to be thinking smarter about where we can improve that will also save the taxpayers some money so that we can put it in the right places.
Well, one thing that I think would be a big benefit to all of us throughout the state is, I mean, we have a lot of smart IT people in this state. I find it hard to believe we can't come up with our own voter registration system that everybody's using. It's the same database. Duplicates are not a problem anymore.
Well, this is where this open source digital voting approach is designed to be available for statewide use, if possible. They are actually borrowing top quality IT people in California to work on it, and they have foundation funding, and it's in part for all the reasons that you named. And I've already told them that I thought that Ohio would be interested. They should talk to you, Mike.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Cheryl Browning from Jackson. Director of the Board of Elections. It would be really nice, you know, we get all of these NCOA cards back. Part of them have addresses on them. The other part are just no forwarding addresses or anything. When these people go into the post office and say, I want to change my address, it would be really nice if the post office would print us off electronically a list like the Health Department does with our deceased Ohioans. It would be wonderful if they would send us a copy of these people each month so we can send something to them and say, hey, it looks like you might have moved, instead of having all of these thousands and thousands and thousands of NCOA cards that we have to send out and pay postage on for them to send them back to us. This is a huge burden on all of our counties, the postage on all of this stuff. And, you know, it seems to me like somehow that the state could bargain with our post office on a bulk rate on this stuff for the counties to be able to do this at a little bit lesser rate. And also, we were talking a little bit earlier about activity and non-activity. We would like to have, or I would anyway, like to have a stricter line of what each county is allowed to consider activity and what we don't have to consider activity. Some counties count petitions as activity, some counties don't. And it would be nice to have a guideline saying, these are what we want as activities, so we're all on the same page.
Very good point. Very good point.
Do we have other questions or comments from some of the elections officials in the room? Some of the, go ahead, go right ahead. That's what we're here for.
We highlight our voter registration cards too. I love the box in the signature box for them to sign up, sign on. So when we go to clean them up, we don't have the big black line through the middle of them, that the signature that we have to clean up. But we have found with our digital scanning that if you use something other than yellow highlight, it blocks the signature. So, and it would be nice to have, instead of the lines, you know, part here and part here, just have a single row going down so they know, you know, they haven't missed this part over here.
Okay. Those are usability points as well as printing. That's great. Other thoughts? This is your opportunity to talk to a man who can take it back to the system, these both of these.
Hello, it's me again. This is also for Tom. The last comment triggered my thought also about the disparity that exists between what constitutes voter activity. That's a real issue out there because people are staying on the rolls in some county because the petition issue. Our vendor, who serves 53 counties, tells us it's about half and half on petitions of his clients. And so that's a real issue. Also, that's going to come up with regard to NVRA, which is we just sunsetted the 60-day notification for identification. We have been flagging the books for the return, what you call 10K, which is the voter notification mailing. The question, the disparity that's likely to exist among boards of elections are twofold. Number one, should we continue to flag our books for the May election and beyond for those who had returned voter notification cards, or did that provision sunset as well? Number two, are they going to be a part of the list maintenance process? Are they going to be part of what triggers return mail through? Is that return mail for NVRA purposes as well? And I could see counties going in both directions. This might be an opportunity at the front door to create some consistency on that. Either way, you know, it doesn't really matter. We just need to know. I've read the statute. I can't see anything in there that says take it out, stop flagging the books. But you know, but I could see someone who could come to another conclusion.
I don't have an answer to the questions, but as much as I am trying to develop competent notes to take back to staff, if you don't mind posing those questions to the election attorney assigned to your county, and that way I know for sure I'll hear at the next legal staff meetings that we have weekly to go over the issues that are coming up from the counties so that we're better prepared when we're writing the directive or considering future issues. And of course, we are in a different structure today than we were last year, and that is we have both permanent and temporary directives. And when we do permanent directives, there's a comment period and a public input period. So from that standpoint, what we do initially, if we think we need to have something in place right away, like for the primary, we can do that through a temporary directive. But if we're trying to put something in place that can be structured there for the future, then obviously we want to take a permanent directive approach if we can. And nonetheless, some of these issues could be part of legislative change. That way you're not dependent on one Secretary of State's directive from year to year. We actually have it encoded in the law as to what the standard would be.
We still have about 10 minutes left, so please. Yes.
Hi, I'm Scott Novakowski from Demos. We're a nonprofit advocacy and research organization. I just have two quick points. The first one, I want to take Chris up on his invitation to talk about designated agency registration, although it's not exactly the specific topic of this section. You know, there's been a lot of talk about changes in laws that could be made, which is great. I just want to also you know, encourage everyone to look at and make sure existing laws are being implemented in the ways that they should be. We've, at Demos, we've done work with states all over the country on implementing specifically the public assistance provisions of the National Voter Registration Act. By and large, it's not happening in states across the country. There's been pending litigation in Ohio since 2006 on this issue. The Sixth Circuit just ruled that the director of the public assistance agency, as well as the secretary, has both the responsibility and the authority to ensure the counties are implementing the law. And, you know, we've seen evidence in the past, and just looking at the most recent numbers that we've seen, it seems to be getting worse, if anything, within the past couple years. And so that actually ties in, I think, to the discussion we've been having here, in that in other states that we've been working with, there are definitely ways to use and improve technology in public assistance agencies. So when they're doing voter registration, their computer systems can link directly to the elections database the ways that DMVs do or BMVs in Ohio. Which again, you know, cuts down on errors, all those sort of things, and also make sure that the agencies are in full compliance with the law. So I just wanted to just raise that.
Thank you. I would mention that one of my law students in election law wrote the paper that she worked with Norman that gave rise to the lawsuit. And she went to a number of public assistance agencies and found zero information. She found one person who was a staffer who had some memory that there had been at one time some voter registration forms. So that Norman played a great part in that as well. Pam?
Hi, thanks. There have been some really great usability suggestions here today that I've heard, and in a panel yesterday, I asked Matt Damschroeder if it was a usability panel, and I asked him if he knew if the registration form had any kind of overhaul recently, because I know where I come from, California, they did something like that recently. I had a group of people work on it and really streamlined it and made some big differences in how usable it is, thus getting better responses. And he said it hadn't happened in a while. The thought that came up for me, Design for Democracy that is working with the EAC will look at ballot design for usability issues, as will folks at the Brennan Center, and they worked with the Usability Professionals of America for the their Better Ballots book. And I wondered if maybe someone had thought about approaching Design for Democracy or the EAC and Design for Democracy to do something like that with respect to the kinds of forms that you have to send out and get back, such as the registration.
It's a great idea, Pam. Go ahead.
Although I need to be careful in commenting on the Section 7 responses on the motor voter law because of the pending litigation, I think we can say the current administration of the Secretary of State's office has recognized the needs in terms of Ohio in that area, and we have done so by creating a Voting Rights Institute whose responsibility is not just voter education, but voter registration and coordination with those designated agencies. And we have grown that staff, not only from a director and an executive assistant, which was kind of our approach in the first year, but we now have a program outreach coordinator, Chris Hughes, who's standing up here, but also a program and outreach specialist who's located in our Cleveland office, and we also have a project coordinator. So we are making sure we have the staff levels needed to work both with the County Board of Elections, working with voting rights groups, but also working with those designated agencies to see that we are in full compliance in terms of the responsibilities Ohio and its agencies have, but also in terms of looking for the new directions and the new efforts that need to be made to go even beyond what the minimum requirements are mandated, whether by federal or state law.
And I'll also say that Scott's input has been very valuable in helping us kind of move that conversation forward. Do we have any other further comments or questions? If not, I'm going to ask the panel to wrap up. We have about 5 to 10 minutes left, and anybody else, anything to add? Okay, go ahead,
you go first.
Well, I was going to see if Candace had any more information that she could convey to the audience on the digital signature aspect in terms of the security and but then the opportunity that some other states are moving ahead with this approach and how it could be one for Ohio to consider in its future.
Thank you for mentioning that. The research I did by talking to top quality computer scientists is that digital signatures can mean a variety of different things, and right now they are not ready for prime time for voter registration. So keep that in mind when top computer security scientists say, not ready for prime time, those of us who are not computer scientists should pay attention. And so that's the message that I would take to policymakers here and nationally. We may get to that point, we are not there now, and it would endanger the legitimacy, the integrity of our voter registration system. Go ahead, Ned. You want to come to the...
one quick question about that and what one means by digital signature. If a written signature has been electronically uploaded into a system, would that be different than something else that might be considered a digital signature? Because I take it the Arizona method of online registration, you can't complete a registration form online unless there is an electronically held copy of what was originally a physical signature that's been added to the system. And it would seem to me that the computer issues with that are very different than what might otherwise be called a digital signature.
You put your finger on a very good point, and that is that I think many of the databases for registration in our counties have the digitized signature, right? Yeah. But if there is a digitized signature in someone's personal computer, which is also at the Board of Elections, that can very easily be hacked, picked up, and used by others. I mean, that's something that needs to be understood. It can also, part of the insecurity of our systems right now is how easy it is to hack into local Board of Elections systems. Just keep in mind, if you think your systems are secure, that I had one of my law students who was also a software engineer, IBM specialist, who was brought to U.S. military installations when their communications were brought down by a foreign espionage. Now, this is remote espionage into our military. It can be done. We need to keep that in mind. Anybody who is serious about it, we can hack into this. So we've got to have some additional protections, and we don't have them yet.
But I mean, clearly there's a lot of issues of computer security, but I don't know if there's anything distinctive, and I'm not an expert in this particular subfield, but I haven't seen any evidence that Arizona has had particular problems with its approach that is sort of the marginal risk of what Arizona has done relative to the baseline risk. I don't know that that's been demonstrated, and so I think you have to analyze this from the perspective of marginal cost, not just base cost.
I hear what you're saying, and I think that's a very good point, Ned. On that, in the most recent book chapter that is published by the American Bar Association this month, I argue that we need independent assessments of the databases and those kinds of features, because just that we in this room don't know what's going on and whether it's secure, they don't, until a properly designed study for the empirical information. And I would definitely endorse that to see if the marginal cost is small, as you say, the marginal cost and the marginal risk. Thank you.
And I think we heard on our luncheon speaker from the Pew Foundation that, again, this is an area they're monitoring, if not supporting, in terms or evaluating as to what's happening in Arizona or in Washington State on their electronic voter registration systems.
Anything else, Nate? Sure.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I will put in my two cents on this whole issue. I'm 30 years old. I don't do really anything by paper anymore. You guys, many of you are older. It is completely...
Do we stone him when he leaves?
It is completely irrational but true that people who are my age, it is anathema for them to have to fill out a piece of paper and put it in the mail and have a stamp and do all of that, you know? So I know in Arizona and in Washington, I believe it's up and running and has been for some time. They have this, and I don't know whether it's secure at all. For all I know, anyone could do anything with that information. But as a political matter, I think that this is going to happen. At some time in the next 20 years, there's going to be online voter registration in Ohio. So you should just keep that in mind. And whatever you do to the voter registration system in between now and when that happens, keep it in the back of your mind. Don't build it in a way that is going to make that extremely costly or difficult to administer. That's all.
Any other questions or comments from anyone? Okay, if you could please give our panel thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your.